The first reading this morning is taken from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to Isaac Tiffany in 1819. Tiffany was a young man from a small town in New York State who asked the former president about the quality of a certain translation of Aristotle. After several exchanges, Jefferson offered the following definition of freedom, of liberty.
Liberty, I would say, is unobstructed action according to our will. But rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. I do not add within the limits of the law, because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the right of an individual.
The second reading comes from the excellent work by Annette Gordon Reed called Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, which came out in 1997-1998. This is a slightly longer reading, but it tells an amazing story that I've never heard before.
In October 1994, the Association of the Bar of the City of New York sponsored a mock trial of Thomas Jefferson. The issue to be decided by the trial was whether examples of hypocrisy in Jefferson's life significantly diminished his contributions to American society. Charles Ogletree of the Harvard Law School served as the prosecutor of the case, and Drew Days, the Solicitor General of the United States, was the attorney for the defense. William Rehnquist of the United States Supreme Court presided as trial judge. The jury consisted of audience members, including myself and my husband. We arrived early to get a seat. The irony was exquisite. Two distinguished black attorneys stood in front of a predominantly white audience and presented the cases for and against Thomas Jefferson, a man who had owned blacks and disparaged their mental abilities. That this event was made possible because some of the other loftier ideals Jefferson expounded is clear. What is less clear is whether he would have been delighted or horrified at the thought. After presenting their opening arguments, the lawyers called historians as expert witnesses to make their respective cases. Each talked about Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, with his plantations worked by black slaves, Jefferson, the Republican, with his royal tastes in food, wine, and property, Jefferson, proponent of the rights of man and opponent of the rights of women. When it came to a vote, my husband and I, along with the overwhelming majority of the other members of the audience, voted in favor of Jefferson. Note that the trial was not about whether Thomas Jefferson was prone to hypocrisy, which seems to have been taken as a given. The question for the evening was whether we were willing to forgive him for it. That the answer would be yes was never in doubt. Even the prosecutor expressed relief in the decision. After all, Jefferson's authorship of the Declaration of Independence lifted him above the rest of the Founding Fathers. His vision of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has been taken to heart by Americans, many of whom seem to think this triumvirate of rights is guaranteed by the Constitution. Thus, it is often said that Jefferson is the personification of America. His strengths are the strengths of the country, and the same can be said of his weaknesses. For this reason, the knowledge that Jefferson himself did not live up to the vision he set before us has troubled some Americans from his time until today.
Thank you.
That song was by William Billings, who was one of the truly great colonial era composers. And undoubtedly, Jefferson, during his lifetime, heard that tune. It was more than four decades ago that I went with my family on a summer vacation trip to visit Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's plantation home in his beloved Virginia. I remember that my folks were particularly delighted when they found out that Monticello was an Italian word, meaning little mountain, and they were overjoyed to find out that Mr. Jefferson not only knew Italian fluently, but was the very first person on these shores to eat both pasta and tomatoes regularly in his diet. Everyone else around here in those days had convinced themselves that tomatoes, because they were part of the nightshade family, were deadly poisonous and wouldn't touch them. Jefferson had noticed on his travels that neither the Italians nor the French were the worse for wear because they ate tomatoes, so he cultivated them himself in his magnificent gardens. And these gardens also impressed my folks, who kept wishing aloud that my grandfathers could be there, the two green thumbs in our family, just to see the intricate beds and garden structures that Jefferson had designed. I don't remember much more than that now. I suppose we saw the inside of the place with its many Jeffersonian inventions of delight. And perhaps we were told about his slaves and shown their quarters. I just don't remember that now. I sort of remember the outside of the house because it had a dome on top, and that delighted me. But that's what I remember. In trying to unpack the meanings of the word freedom this month, I naturally thought of Mr. Jefferson. Although my memory of Monticello was in fragments, my memory of his mighty words on liberty were still echoing through my soul decades after I first read them or heard them read. I don't know about you, but my schooling was filled with Jefferson. Not just life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and the Declaration of Independence, but his masterwork, the Statute of Virginia on Religious Freedom. The names of both of these works he actually engraved on his tombstone because he considered them his principal memorial. Now, his understanding of religious freedom and his understanding of political freedom, represented by these two amazing writings, seemed to contrast a great deal. For Jefferson, political freedom meant the right and power of the citizens to check the government as often as they needed to. God forbid, he wrote William Smith in 1787, God forbid we should ever be 20 years in this country without rebellion. The people cannot be all and always well informed, he wrote. If they remain quiet under such misconceptions, it is lethargy, the forerunner of death to liberty. And what country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? So I have to imagine that Mr. Jefferson would have applauded the 11,000 of us who were down by the State House yesterday afternoon, proclaiming without any lethargy our own spirit of resistance to the recently passed and deeply controversial bill. Jefferson, in fact, went a lot further in his understanding of rebellion than we did yesterday. He called for the shedding of patriot blood in such purifying uprisings of the people. But his understanding of religious freedom is completely distinct from these political notions of spilled blood and rebellion. Religious freedom, in fact, wants no spilled blood, not one drop. Rather, it focuses instead on the right of religious individuals to freely live next door to people of wildly differing viewpoints and religions, with the caveat that all of these different religions have to leave each other alone. For Jefferson, no one can be forced to support or abandon any religion. No one can be forced to believe anything they do not believe. And Jefferson wanted non-believers in Virginia to trust that religious freedom was for them too. And since they too, and so that they too could run for office and be elected, because there could be no religious test for public office. In 1779, he wrote in his essay on religious freedom, "Our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions. Our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions any more than on our opinions of physics or geometry." He went on for pages uplifting that very strong principle. Of course, Jefferson's rather high opinion of religious freedom has fallen on hard times. In Ohio, I am not allowed to get married, nor would my marriage be considered a civil right were I to try and get married. I have no right. My own religious institution, my Unitarian Universalist church, congregation, religion, has no problem with religious ceremonies like the ones that unite people of the same gender. And I myself have performed these ceremonies since 1979, despite the state's view of my religious belief. But only religions which are against such civil rights are allowed to affect policy in Ohio on this and on many other issues. There appear to be right religions and wrong religions in our state. Ours is obviously on the wrong side of some issues according to the legislation and elected leadership of our state. Now, Jefferson relished his own religious freedom personally. He took great pleasure in describing himself with a whole variety of religious views. He never claimed to be an atheist, although he was certainly and vehemently labeled as one during his election times by all of his critics, of which there were many. Despite the label of atheist, he still managed to get elected president. Today, some 200 years later, I would need paddles to restart my heart if even a mildly agnostic Unitarian Universalist was ever considered for presidential office longer than 2 minutes. Yet Jefferson didn't let other people describe his religious views. He offered his own self-evaluation many times. In a letter to Charles Thompson, he offered, in his words, "proof that I'm a real Christian," unquote. The proof? His privately printed little edition of the Gospels with all the miracles and resurrection stories removed with scissors. This is the so-called Jefferson Bible. It's still available today at your local bookstore if it hasn't closed, or on Amazon.com if it has. Of course, no modern megachurch pastor down the street would agree that Jefferson was a real Christian in their understanding of the term. To lift up Jesus as a sort of Socrates, a philosopher of the good life, as Jefferson did to prove his Christian credentials, would hardly keep him out of eternal hellfire, according to Rod Parsley. But Jefferson's personal religious freedom proved very eclectic indeed. To John Adams in 1820, he boasted of his creed of materialism. To Ezra Ely in 1819, he wrote, "I am a sect all by myself." But he also claimed to be an anti-Trinitarian in an 1816 letter to a man named Van de Kamp, referring sarcastically to the idea of the Trinity as the abracadabra of mountebanks. What a great phrase that is. And of course, he also claimed to be a Unitarian in a letter to Benjamin Waterhouse in 1822, and an Epicurean in an 1819 letter to William Short, Epicurus being the Greek philosopher touting a simple, elegant life of virtue and humanistic calm. Jefferson loved the Greek and Roman philosophers and was taken not just by Epicurus, but as I said, by Seneca the Younger, whose writings on liberty clearly inspired his own writings. So Mr. Jefferson found a half dozen ways to express himself about his religious proclamations. I don't think it means he was wriggling out of some commitment. After all of these religious claims are in the same general ballpark. It's not like he's saying that he's a Shia Muslim, a Christopher Hitchens atheist, a Krishna-centered Hindu, and a Lakota shaman all at the same time. To think that would be a distortion of Jefferson's personal religious freedom. It's simpler for me to think that Jefferson just had a lively, eclectic vocabulary, like many people in this room, and he used different words to say different things to very different people. He's not hurting anyone or restraining anyone with all of his spiritual vitality. And this does fit the definition of liberty he offered to Isaac Tiffany very neatly. Remember, liberty, I would say, is unobstructed action according to our will. But rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. It's a brilliant definition, based on Greek and Roman philosophy, to be sure. I do have to admit that it heavily stresses the individual as primary and the community as secondary, something which I question. But all in all, it's pretty clear and clean, and this is exactly where Jefferson gets into trouble. For it's clear that for Jefferson, unobstructed action according to his will meant refusing to let the equal rights of others, namely his slaves, ever deprive him of his own need to do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. And this is why Jefferson, despite his undeniable brilliance around religious freedom and in the Declaration, has always had a troubling reputation in the later years of this nation. He was often completely vilified during the Civil War because of his hypocrisy in keeping slaves while writing so beautifully about liberty. His individualistic bent got him into trouble during the New Deal era, where his patrician class attitudes smudged over his brilliant cadenzas on liberty and freedom. And recently, there has been this whole thing about his slave, Sally Hemings. Frankly, Annette Gordon Reed makes it clear that the actual evidence about Sally Hemings and Jefferson having children together is still ultimately inconclusive. The DNA tests don't prove anything finally because there were other men with the same DNA, Jefferson's brother, who could have fathered those children. I tend to think that Jefferson did father them because of the dates of her pregnancies. But the fact is, in the end, whether or not they had children together is not the issue. The issue is that he preached liberty and kept slaves. The issue is that he claimed to own Sally Hemings. The issue is that many of the white historians who have written about this were troubled more by the fact that Jefferson, a man of English ancestry, bonded with Sally Hemings, a woman of African ancestry, a black and white person in a bed together. That's what bothered many of the white historians looking at this event. And please, this is not some outdated attitude from the antebellum past. just this week, and some of you probably read this, April 7th, 2011, a reliable poll showed that 46% of the Republican voters in the state of Mississippi think that black and white marriage should be made illegal again. Forget that whole gay marriage thing. Bring back the old days when blacks and whites were separate and unequal. It's unbelievable. I wept when I read it. At first, I thought that Jefferson might have agreed with the voters of Mississippi, since he didn't have a very high opinion of black people. He thought they were inferior intellectually and said so, and limited in what they could possibly achieve in their lives. And yet, I just don't know. When a white friend of his wanted to marry one of his slaves, he gladly approved the selling of this black woman to his friend so they could get married. He never dissed their marriage. He retained friendship with this man and with this woman for years afterward. There can be no doubt that Jefferson was the most complex of human beings. But here we're back to the original problem. Jefferson, father of our liberty, kept slaves. In 1782, he wrote, and without any shame, "In a warm climate, no man will labor for himself who can make another labor for him." This is so true that of the proprietors of slaves, a very small proportion indeed are ever seen to labor. So there you have it. Virginia was his home. Virginia has a warm climate. And so Jefferson had others labor for him. Now, he didn't hire a house cleaner. He owned a house cleaner. He didn't hire a gardener. He owned a gardener. And there is nothing good or just or free in such a notion. Jefferson simply could not put into practice his undeniably brilliant definition of liberty in his letter to Isaac Tiffany. Rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within lines drawn around us by the equal rights of others. Rightful freedom is not doing whatever you want, whenever you want. There are other people in the world. Rightful freedom sometimes surprisingly demands that we box ourselves in, restrain ourselves, hold ourselves back a bit. The children's story about a young slave mailing himself to freedom in a box is a completely brilliant image arising from an absolutely true historical story. Henry found his freedom by allowing himself to be constrained in a box. Our liberty is entirely dependent on the limits, the box, that we are willing to draw around our own freedoms by valuing the equal rights of others as the cost of our own. My capacity to marry is actually related to your capacity to marry. My capacity to be free is actually related to your capacity to be free. There are, you see, no classes of humanity that the title fully human doesn't apply to. Every color expresses full humanity. Every sexual preference expresses full humanity. Every gender or age or ability expresses full humanity. Every broken mind and wounded heart expresses full humanity. And even a deeply flawed practitioner of liberty like Thomas Jefferson expresses full humanity. Thomas Jefferson is a cautionary reminder of ourselves. As Annette Gordon Reed put it in the first reading, it is often said that Jefferson is the personification of America. His strengths are the strengths of the country, and the same can be said for his weaknesses. I agree. In other words, any human being here in America that claims to be perfect, all strength, no weaknesses, misses the boat. But any human being who doesn't work at trying to practice a stronger liberty, a stronger love, a stronger justice, and a stronger honesty has also missed the boat and tossed aside the best and most brilliant dreams Jefferson himself had for this nation. Like I said, I don't remember seeing the slave quarters near the gardens of Monticello, but I know they were there, inhabited for many years by people who were as fully an expression of humanity as was Jefferson. The mock court trial, while acknowledging his hypocrisy, voted to forgive Jefferson in the end because of that common humanity. I wonder, after spending so much time this week with this amazing, aggravating man, how I would have voted were I sitting at that trial in the audience, in the jury. But since I, too, am a fully human American with flaws aplenty, I wonder how Jefferson would vote if he was there and I was the one that was on trial. Or you.